Karen Strobe was an actress and a director. When her dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, she became a caregiver. I'm Charity Nebbe on the next Talk of Iowa. In learning how to best care for her father, Strobe discovered that her life in the theater gave her tools she could use. She now travels the country sharing what she learned with others. I'll talk with her today, and also Mercedes Byrne-Klug, a professor of social work and director of the Aging Studies Program at the University of Iowa. We'll talk about the challenges involved in caring for our aging loved ones, some of the strategies we can use to improve everyone's quality of life, the partnerships we need to create to develop a caring community and a safety net, and the joy we can find in sharing a loved one's final years. We'd also like to hear from you. The number is 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For many of us, there comes a time in life when our parents stop caring for us and we need to start caring for them. It may be a gradual transition or it could be quite sudden, but it's a reality that most of us will face. Karen Strobe was an actress, a director, a writer, a theater instructor when her dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. She now shares what she learned about caring for someone with dementia with others all over the country, and she's here with us today. Hello, Karen.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Tell me what happened when you discovered that your father had Alzheimer's disease.
Well, as you said, I was meeking out a living as much as you can as an actress and writer, and I did a lot of improvisational theater, and I literally felt something hit me like a button, a switch, something went off that I had to find out as much as I could about this disease, because at that time I really knew hardly anything. I mean, it was, yes, Ronald Reagan had it. It was something about memory, and I thought you only got it when you were very old. So I noticed one day that all of my theater books had taken the bottom shelf, and all these dementia conference handouts and books and everything had taken precedent. And it's an amazing, scary disease. And I dove in head first. And the youngest of six kids, I was a daddy's little girl kind of feeling, in that he was a stubborn German man that came over from Germany, was born there. And my oldest sisters are the baby boomer generation. My oldest sister is in the very first year, and I'm in the very last year. And had a totally different childhood than my sisters, who are 18 and 16 and 14 years older than I am, that they wore him down. He would turn into this giant, sweet, old teddy bear of a German man that I had a total different relationship with him. So, and yes, it is scary. And it is, I believe that you, when you hear a diagnosis, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or another disease that is going to end in death, it is a terminal disease, that you as the caregiver, a family member, as the person, you begin to go through Kubler-Ross's stages of grief then. It's not when the person dies. You start going through the anger, the denial, the frustration, the depression. As they proceed through the disease, you go through that too.
How old was your dad when he was diagnosed?
Dad was, let me think back now. He was 78. He was 78. And he had several other things going on at the same time. And he had several strokes that were happening. And we couldn't get his strokes under control. And his disease progressed fairly quickly.
How far away from home were you living when this diagnosis came?
7 hours. And I know that route. I think I could drive that route now blindfolded. They were living outside of St. Louis area in Illinois, and I was up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I made that trip many, many, many times. And we all did. I had a sister in St. Louis that became the primary support for my mom. And then I was the backup support that went down and relieved her to relieve mom. And so we all made it pretty much a family affair.
And a year after your father was diagnosed?
My dad passed away on October 13th of the year 2000. And a year later, my mom was diagnosed with mixed early dementia, which was vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And the vascular dementia was caused by some strokes she was having And we've gotten that completely under control. And she's been living now for the past 9 years with Alzheimer's disease. And she, it was truly an interesting process of the diagnosis for her, because the whole family was in denial that how could mom have it too? There's no way. But then her and I knew something was going on. And her whole response when we finally got this diagnosis, and it took about 9 months, maybe a little bit longer, of continual visits and more tests to make sure, and kind of crossing off, okay, it's not this. It's not depression because of my dad's death. It's not this. When they finally came up with that diagnosis, we sat in the car in the parking lot, and I looked at her and I said, Mom, do you know, understand completely what the doctor just said? And she said, yes. She said, he said, I've got what daddy had. I've got Alzheimer's disease. And I said, right. And I said, are you okay? And she said, you know, I just thought I was going crazy. I really couldn't imagine it could be this, but at least there's something I can do. Because she thought she was just losing her mind.
When you got involved in taking care of your dad, and now you're the primary caregiver for your mom, how did that change your identity?
How much time do we have? that's a huge question. I don't think it changed too much with my dad, except when you think about the family dynamic of the baby sister. I'm the youngest, like I said, and that dynamic is an interesting one. When you become the most educated in a subject, yet it's dealing with a parent and you're the baby. That's the only thing I think that really changed with my father. But with my mother, I've really noticed and felt the change to my identity. There's a lot of books out there. There's a lot of amazing, amazing family members that are writing books. And I think the reason you see so many is because it is this form of therapy for the family, for the person. And you see a lot of professionals writing books. And there's a lot of books out there, and there's nothing wrong with them. They're wonderful, but there's a lot that focus just on he's not himself anymore. I'm losing him, the long, dark journey that are all about that I'm losing my father, I'm losing my mother. And although I felt that with my father, my feelings with my mom have been much more about I'm losing me. And I think because we've been with her more through these earlier years, and I've seen the progression of she doesn't remember my childhood anymore. I'm the youngest, and it's basically swiped from her memory. So whenever you talk about home to her, she thinks that means home when she grew up in the log cabin in West Virginia, very poor, poor time, the youngest of 8 children. And there's no identity as I am a daughter to her anymore. So it's really about I have no conversations about my growing up, my family life with her. So I start losing bits of me with her.
Also with us today is Mercedes Byrne-Klug. She's a professor of social work and director of the Aging Studies Program at the University of Iowa. Mercedes, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Karen was just talking about some of the emotions she felt in becoming a caregiver to her parents and some of the changes that she's felt in herself. What kinds of things do people experience when they suddenly reach this part of life where they realize they need to take care of their parents?
I think Karen's really expressed her feelings very well, and I think that many of your listeners are probably able to identify with what she's saying. We're dealing with a few things. One is it's news that nobody really wants to get. I mean, nobody wants to think that they're going to be getting dementia. And frankly, any of the chronic illnesses that often occur as we get older. Dementia is in its own category because it is the you lose the ability to relate in the same way, and that's at the heart of the relationship. And so I think there are unique and particularly strong challenges when families are faced with dementia. We also see challenges with any of the chronic illnesses that can accompany aging as they progress and people lose function. And so it's kind of like a dance between the adult children and the older adults in terms of what is this relationship now, and how do we each continue to express our love and enjoy each other, but still get things done that the elder may not be able to do anymore. And it brings a whole lot of stress if people aren't able to discuss things openly, and if people have very, very different ideas about what's going on or different ideas about what should go on. Because for most of the children's life, the parents weighed in on what should happen or maybe dictated in some cases. And so now when you have that person who has had the traditional leadership becoming impaired, families need to negotiate and work out how that gap's going to be filled, and some families do it better than others.
Karen, you wanted to add something?
Good points, Mercedes. And I want to just add on that there's another identity in this whole picture is the children, is that we talk about the sandwich generation. We've heard that term quite a bit. But I have one daughter, and she's grown up with basically, I've always said, being a caregiver for her grandma. Even though grandma was doing great, you know, for many, many years of her life. But there's also this balance as dance you've got to do to make sure that you don't raise your child resenting your mother or father when you're in this situation either. So there's this whole other dynamic when you put into the grandkids into this picture.
I agree completely. I also think that we don't have many good examples of multi-generational families that work. And much of our society is very age segregated. And by that, I mean, if you're a teenager, you do certain things. If you're an elder, you hang out certain places. There are just a few places in our society where you see mixed generations. And so with the whole situation with your daughter or your mother's granddaughter, places that your daughter would typically be going don't usually have a grandmother. And then if you add a grandmother who's not able to communicate or relate as well, I think that adds some other stress. And it can feel very, very isolating.
We'll talk more about the challenges of taking care of our elderly loved ones in a moment. My guests today are Karen Stobie and also Mercedes Byrne-Klug, who's a professor of social work and director of aging studies at the University of Iowa. We'd love to hear from you as well. We'd love to hear about things that have gone on in your family. If you need advice, if you have questions, give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about caring for our elderly loved ones. My guests are Karen Stobie. She was an actress and a director when her dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. She became his caregiver. She now takes care of her mother, who also has Alzheimer's disease. And she travels the country sharing what she's learned from her experiences with other people facing similar challenges. We also have with us today Mercedes Byrne-Klug, who's a professor of social work and director of the Aging Studies Program at the University of Iowa. And you're welcome to join our conversation. I know this is something that many of us are dealing with. If you have questions about your situation or a story that you'd like to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Karen, I want to start with you, and Mercedes, I want your input on this as well. When you have that crisis moment, when you realize that you need to become a caregiver to your parents, and for some people it's very gradual, for some people it's a sudden diagnosis or a stroke, something that changes things dramatically. But when you have that realization that now it's time for me to care for my parents and also for your brothers and sisters to take on that role, what do you need to sit down and focus on and figure out?
Well, to first say that it would be great for anybody that's listening that is not in that situation to do that now, to take that time to step back. We were able to, because of my dad's diagnosis, during his illness, be able to do that with my mom and sit and say, what do you want, and get things in order for her and get long-term care insurance in order for her, and as a family, for all of us to think about what are the roles, who can take what role. I also think that it's really good for everyone to keep communicating and to educate yourself as much as possible, but mainly to know your own limitations. You have to be really careful when you're in any kind of, whether your loved one's in a nursing home or assisted living, you're still a caregiver, whether they are in your home, whether they live next door, whether they're 500 miles away. You've got to know your limitations and be able to say yes to the people that want to help you, and know sometimes to when you just can't do it all. So I think that you know, to say yes to help, educate yourself, and to know your own limitations.
Mercedes?
Oh, I think Karen is just, what you're saying is just right on track. And thank you. You have a really good way of expressing this. What I see is that sometimes families think that we're doing a sprint. And so they come in and sign up for a sprint, but really they're for a marathon. And how you prepare for a sprint and how you prepare for a marathon are completely different. And so there is a crisis generally in many families when you realize the situation has changed or is going to change dramatically. But there's a point at which you get some information about a very serious diagnosis, or you see with your own eyes that somebody can't drive anymore or is not able to function or is not able to do their checkbook. I think many times the problem is that families don't realize that this is going to be a process. And whatever we decide about roles and about arrangements is not going to be the end-all and be-all. That the expectation should be, this is what we're going to do for now, and we know that things will change. We don't know how they're going to change, and we don't know when they're going to change, but things are going to change. Whenever you're dealing with a chronic illness that ends in death, and that's what we see in older adulthood with dementias or with a serious heart disease or with serious diabetes, you're in there for the long haul in general, and so it's important to do some pacing. And so Karen's comment about self-care is so important, because if you want to be there for the end of the race, you're going to have to give yourself some permission for breaks along the way. And you're going to have to also give permission to the other people who are involved, because people handle stress and crisis very differently. So if a family's got four kids, you can expect that there'll be four different ways to deal with stress and grief, anxiety, guilt, all those core feelings that shake our sense of who we are will be felt differently by different people. And so it's kind of learning how to respect that in yourself, but also respect it in your loved ones, so that as you journey through this disease with your elder, that it's not at the expense of other relationships. So what Karen was saying before about concerns about her daughter, not wanting her daughter to resent her grandmother, I think that's very important, to retain that sensitivity to everybody's needs. And it can be done, but it's not easy.
Is that something that you see a lot, where the person who is ill ends up becoming kind of the center of the universe of the family, and other things begin to fall away?
I think it depends a lot on the disease and the person. Many people who are in their older adulthood right now grew up in large settings, and so they're not necessarily used to having all the attention on one person. They grew up more in a setting of compromise and collaboration. The next generation, where there were smaller kids, we might be dealing with that more. I think another thing that Karen said that I'd like to mention is that if the family is feeling like it's too much, if the adult children or the grandchildren are feeling that the care needs exceed their ability, don't wait until you get that tired. There are community services available. There are organizations available. And as a social worker, what I see is that most families wait too long to get community groups involved, to start getting Meals on Wheels or start looking for adult day health. So I would say one thing is start looking for ways to support the family much earlier, and then people aren't going to be burned out as quickly.
Karen?
I think that the one big word that stops a lot of families is that big G word of guilt. And that no matter what, we think someone else won't do a good of a job or can't do or won't look to see to make sure of this or that with our loved one, when in essence, I admit it completely, but my husband is a much better caregiver for my mom than I will ever be. He does not have that emotional baggage.
That's right.
Of growing up with this woman. He loves her for who she is, and she loves him, and there's nothing that affects him in the same emotional way that I get. And I know that. And once you can realize that, you know there's other people who are out there who can do that same care. And something you said to Mercedes that, you know, some people don't realize they're in it for the long haul. Truth be told, I think they do. They just want to deny it. They just can't face it. They just are too scared. And they're also scared it's going to happen to them. But you know, it will tear apart your family if you don't look at that this is a long haul. I have the question posed to me all the time from people all over the country that say, how do you know when it's time? And that's really a personal question of when it's time that a person should be talked to about, included in the decision if they can be, about a nursing home or assisted living. But you need to look at as the person who is the primary care or as a family, as a team, what is the health and safety of everyone involved? Is the health and safety of the person that needs the care being compromised, or is anyone in that household's health and safety being compromised? If my daughter's grades were starting to go down, if my marriage started to have problems, if, you know, there's other things to look at that's not just that person. And we hear a lot these days, there's a term that's being floated around that's called person-centered care, that we're looking at taking care of the person instead of just the medical needs of the person, but who is this person? And when you're doing that in a home, you need to look at everyone in that home, not just the person who needs the care.
We had a call, and he didn't want to stay on the line, but he wants to ask, when one son or daughter is taking all of the responsibility of caregiving, how can you get the rest of the family involved? And his situation is that his wife is taking care of her mother, and he feels a lot of anger because she has a lot of family members, but no one is helping her with that care. Karen, how do you get other people involved?
It's a hard one. And I think what we've both said, Mercedes and I, is that people are at different places. Some people are at the acceptance stage and some people are at that denial, the depression, and they cannot handle it whatsoever. I think that she knows, or whomever knows your siblings, and there's some that you could probably say, I need you. You need to almost make it a polite command and say, your mom needs you and I need you. Please, can you come? I think the other thing that you can do, and perhaps the husband can do to support his wife, is to send out and educate. Just keep sending out those little kind emails about the statistics on caregiving and more about the disease of the person and more about, and keep updating. And the best responses I've ever had is to say, I need you. I need this. Please.
Mercedes, when somebody is in that stage where they're trying to figure out what kind of help is available, what kinds of things they need to be doing to support their loved one, to care for their loved one, what kind of resources are available for them?
I think you want to check in with, you can check in with a case manager. I think here in Iowa City, and we are dealing with something called the Livable Communities Initiative. And that's a group, a large group of people from many different walks of life who are getting together to try to make Iowa City a good place to grow up and a good place to grow old. And so there's an awful lot of community education about end-of-life related things, chronic illness things. And across the state, too, there are places called Area Agencies on Aging. In fact, wherever you live in the United States, there's an Area Agency on Aging responsible for communicating about the services available to older adults in that geographic locale. So the first thing to do, I would say, is check in with your local Area Agency on Aging and find out what kind of information they have. Some people want information personally. They want to sit down with a case manager or a social worker or an individual and find out, okay, here's my situation. What do I need to do? I want a plan. Other people would be scared to death to do that, and they are much more comfortable being one of maybe 30 people in a room, hearing a presentation, benefiting from other people's questions, and then they're going to take it slowly or take it a different route. But if you were going to just do one thing, I would check with the Area Agency on Aging. And then also, we've been talking a lot about Alzheimer's and dementia. There's a network of Alzheimer's support groups across the country. These are some paid staff, a lot of volunteers, and people who really understand what can happen to a family. They have support groups usually. Now we've got support groups on computer, e-line support groups in some cases too. It's just getting to the point where you realize I'm open to hearing somebody else's ideas. And when people will get to that point, then they're doing the information gathering. And I think what all of us want are options. We don't want to feel trapped. And so the caller who mentioned, you know, only one child is doing this, it's very hard to make adults do things they don't want to do. And if that person's siblings really don't want to be involved, I'm not sure I'd put a whole lot of effort into that. Sometimes they want to be involved, but they don't know how. And the person who's doing the main caregiving is like, how could they not know how? This is so obvious. Well, you would be surprised. So I think making a list of things you could use some help with and then letting people know. And if they self-select, fine. But the last thing you want is to be involving family members who really don't want to be involved, because then things aren't going to be done well.
Yeah, and the person's not going to get good care from those people who don't want to be there either. And there's other people in your community that perhaps can step in and help that may be better than those family members at this present time.
I want to talk a little bit about nursing homes. For a lot of people, a nursing home is the worst scenario. It's a nightmare scenario as we grow older to think about the possibility that we might end up in a nursing home. Things, of course, there are many different kinds of nursing homes, and things are changing in that world. But when the time comes that somebody cannot live in their own home, Mercedes, how do you evaluate the options?
Well, first of all, we need to recognize that there are nursing homes doing a wonderful job of helping to meet the needs of individuals. So we shouldn't be painting all nursing homes with a broad brush. That being said, most nursing homes in this country are dealing with very serious staffing issues and keeping steady staff. So if I was going to be looking for a nursing home for a loved one, I'd be very interested in how do they deal with being short-staffed. The other thing is, as part of healthcare reform that was just passed this year, there's going to be a lot more money put into services outside of nursing homes, really beginning next October, a year from now. So I'm really hoping that they don't change healthcare reform or they don't try to appeal it, because this is really going to change everything in terms of giving options to individuals and families who would like to postpone or prevent going to a nursing home. There's going to be a lot more resources available to keep people in the community. And by that, I mean they would be living at home or living at the home with someone else, but getting some services into the home, or there would be places in the community that, like an adult child who was working, could drop their parent off at this adult day health center while they're working and know that the person is safe and know that the person's getting fed, maybe getting a bath. And so all sorts of ways to help keep people living as independently as possible. And we have a lot to thank the disability community for that, because the disability community has really been opening the eyes of the older adult advocates in realizing that institutionalization is not the only answer at all. And when a state puts most of its resources into institutions, then really we're eliminating options for our elders and for our families.
And I think that word that you just used there, Mercedes, is something that we're working to change, is that word institutionalize. In that, you know, I think that's the fear that a lot of us, when we walk into a nursing home, we feel like we're in that old-fashioned kind of institution. And there's a lot of good work and a lot of wonderful nursing homes and organizations across the country who are trying to make it more into home. And I think that if you guys Google, too, there's some wonderful nursing home checklists that are out there that you can go in and be prepared. Don't be embarrassed. Prepare yourself. Be an advocate and walk in with a checklist. The Pioneer Network's got a great one on their website about culture change and what to look for in a nursing home.
You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. My guests are Karen Stobe. She's a consultant for caregivers. You can find information from her on the website inthemoment.com. And also Mercedes Byrne Klug is a professor of social work and the director of aging studies at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about taking care of our aging loved ones. We've been focused particularly on taking care of people who suffer from dementia, but we're talking about taking care of people as they age and whatever ailments they may be experiencing. My guests today are Mercedes Byrne Klug. She's a professor of social work and director of the Aging Studies Program at the University of Iowa, and Karen Stobe, who was an actress and director. She became a caregiver, and now she has traveled the country sharing what she learned about taking care of her father and her mother, who both have suffered from Alzheimer's disease, with other people who are facing the same situations. And Karen, in taking care of your dad, you had an epiphany. You had a moment where you realized that some of the things that you knew about improvisational theater could help you in being a better caregiver. What did you realize?
Well, actually, it happened really close to the end of his life that I was so concentrated on the everyday that I didn't even see this big picture until I took a step back. And truly, this world of improvisation parallels the world of caregiving for someone with Alzheimer's and other people with memory loss. And just in a couple examples, in caregiving, we say, step into their reality, listen to where they are in their mind. And it's the same thing on stage. You use the reality that's given to you on stage. If someone walks on stage and says, "Forgive me, Father, for I've sinned," all of a sudden you're a priest and that's what you are. But the big one that I use a lot in my presentations is the rule of yes and. It's a rule that's in improv that anyone's ever taken a class knows of, that you try to never say no on stage. You try to always say yes and. And when you use that in the world of caregiving, especially with someone with memory loss, but even for any of our elders, we're given this word no more and more and more, whether it's physically, verbally, whether it's in the sense that you don't get any letters from your old pen pals anymore, that you physically can't walk up those steps anymore, that no, don't sit there, no, don't do this, that there's so many losses and no's that come into our life as we age, that if we can change, and instead of telling people, no, don't do that, no, you can't go home, no, you can't do this, and use this positive yes and, because in the world of caregiving, and especially Alzheimer's, we hear this validation technique, and that yes is exactly what it is. You're saying, yes, I understand you, I hear you, and I am here with you, I got it. And then you use that and to redirect the person or to build upon that yes statement. And it's amazing, that simple technique that's true in improv and in Alzheimer's, that I went down the line and I developed a training program that's free on my website that basically uses those ideas and those techniques, that I think, because I'm a non-technical type of person, that I'd rather use people as my training tool and the games and the exercises to train instead of using a PowerPoint or overheads and that kind of thing.
Give me an example of how you would use yes and in a real life situation.
Well, for instance, for those of you who work and breathe and live with the world of dementia, you may have heard someone with Alzheimer's say, I want to go home. And they want to go home. And I want to go home. And there's lots of different reasons why they say this. But what happens a lot of times is if they're in an adult day, you say, no, no, it's not time yet. Your daughter will come get you. If they're living in an assisted living or a nursing home, you say, oh, Miss Sarah, you live here now. It's beautiful. Let me show you your room. And if you truly believe you don't live there and you want to go home, you're going to get more and more angry when someone wants to show you your quote-unquote room. So instead of saying no, use the technique of yes and. So if someone were to say, I want to go home. So if you say that to me.
I want to go home.
Yes. And tell me about your home. Say it again.
I want to go home.
Yes. And it's a little chilly outside. Let's get a sweater. Now, I'm not saying let's go back to your room and get a sweater. I'm just saying let's get a sweater. So what you're doing, you're saying, yes, I hear you. And then you're using that and as a redirection. So instead of directing them to reminisce and talk about the home, direct them, let's go get a sweater. And then by the time you're walking and talking, you're going to see the little puppy that's visiting. They're making cookies. You're going to see something else to redirect that behavior. But you also have to look behind. I just want to make sure that's clear because I don't have a lot of time to go into it. But the behavior is communicating something to you. When they're saying, I want to go home, you've got to look behind that statement. And what is that saying to you?
And how do you do that?
Well, you have to realize that for a lot of people, that statement of I want to go home could mean they're talking about the home they just came from, the home they just moved out of. But for most people, when they say I want to go home, they're talking about this home from 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, that's where they are in their mind, their Alzheimer's mind right then. And that it's so important for family members to understand that, because it's heartbreaking when you see a family member come and pick up dad from the nursing home and crying and saying, I just want to take dad home just for one day. And then he gets back home and he looks at her after 30 minutes and says, I want to go home. The other one is that they might be looking for some of those meanings of home. What does home mean to you? And when you think about that, we all have different meanings. It could be comfort, could be safety, could be your pets, your garden. It could be just your stuff. And that some people, when you have brain disease, you have problems with your communication. And if you're having problems with your communication, they might be using that word home to mean, I don't feel safe here. I don't feel comfortable. So when you look behind a behavior, which saying I want to go home all the time and trying to get out the door is a behavior, see what the meaning, what are they trying to communicate to you?
So just like in theater, you're living in an altered reality. You need to understand what the altered reality of the person you're taking care of is.
Correct. And it's their reality. And it's much easier to jump into that reality than to argue with the person and tell them no. This is 2010, and it doesn't help you whatsoever. There was a point with my dad that he thought he was back during the war, and he fought in World War II. And there was no point in trying to bring him to our reality. We are the ones, that's what we forget sometimes, is that we're the ones that don't have the brain disease. We're supposed to jump into their reality. They can't change. We're the ones that have to change.
You also focus in your training a lot on laughter and finding joy in the moments when you're working with someone with Alzheimer's disease. Is that something that you see a lot of people missing?
Yes and no. It came about because my good friend back in Milwaukee Public Theater, that her answer to just about anything is to put on a show. When she found out about my dad's Alzheimer's, she said, you should write a grant and put on a show. We should put on a show about caregiving. I was like, oh, right, okay. This is a fun subject. But I did get a grant for 3 years. And the first year, I wanted to just spend it very slowly gathering information, finding out from people what would they want the show to be about? What should it be about? And the one common thread I kept hearing from people was, boy, this is stressful. And then I also heard, but you got to find your joy. If you don't find the laughter in each day, if you don't have a sense of humor, then you just need to not do this. And I thought, wow, how powerful, because what laughter does for our bodies and minds and souls is the exact opposite of what stress does to us. So they had found how to take care of their own stress by using joy and laughter. And it's not easy. People aren't ready. Just as we've been talking about, people are in different places, family members, that there's some. I had one gentleman walk out of a room when I was doing some interviews with the support group saying, there's nothing funny about this disease, and I don't think I want to talk about laughter and joy, and you're wrong in even coming to talk about this to us. But that's where he was. I don't blame him. I understand. He just couldn't get there at this point. But most people, I mean, some of the funniest people I've ever met, or some of the times I've hurt myself laughing, has been in a room full of people with Alzheimer's. My mom, just watch out. She's quick, and my dad was the same way. He used humor a lot to deal with his disease and to kind of cover it up and to battle it in his own way.
Mercedes, when we're talking about joy, I know that I've heard from people whose parents have had Alzheimer's disease that, you know, it just doesn't seem like I'm doing any good. I visit them. They don't know who I am. They forget that I visited them the moment that I left. What can you do to make that visit valuable and something that you can use to add something to the life of the person who won't remember it?
I think there, first of all, it's important to stay in touch and literally in touch. So if you don't think the person's going to remember it, things are worth doing even if they aren't remembered. The fact that they're remembered does not give something value or take value away. So if you just are going and sitting next to somebody that you love and holding their hand, that may be enough. Sometimes it might just be like, let's say you're going over to somebody who has entered a nursing home. You might go there, be open to talk with them if they can talk or want to talk. Maybe they don't want to. Then just sit there and write out your bills. And it will be something for the person to watch you writing your bills, and something may come up. Karen's message about joy is so important because we overlook the need for ourselves and for people who have dementia. We all love to laugh. We all love to be amused. We love to be enchanted. And now we're going to have to find different ways to do that, and where it's also something to really celebrate and look for. But you have to get there emotionally, because if you're still in the place where this is a crisis and you're getting used to the whole idea, you haven't gotten used to the new life that you now have, not just the person with dementia, but the whole family now has a new twig of their life tree, you might say. Your life is changing. In ways you didn't anticipate and you probably wouldn't have asked for. But now that that's the way it is, how do you make the most of it? And what we hear from some people is that it ended up changing them, making them more gentle, making them a softer person, a more sensitive person, whatever it might be. If you want to be part of your loved one's life as they journey with Alzheimer's or something else, if you are willing to take that journey with them, then be open to the gifts that will come with that. And also there's going to be some heartache and a lot of sadness and some, you know, it's that guilt word, you know, can you get past the guilt of not doing enough? That give yourself permission to do what you can and spend, I think it's important just to spend some time there, even if you're not sure what you're going to do. We don't have to be that task-oriented. Sometimes you can just sit and watch TV together or look out the window together or bring a pet in or something like that if you want. If you're not sure what to do, talk to the activities director, talk to the social worker, ask the certified nurse aides. They're the ones who spend the most time with people in nursing homes. They can give you all sorts of ideas of what your loved one says they like to do during the day or how they react to different things. So it's a matter of asking.
Karen?
I also want to just say that even if the person doesn't remember who you are or even that you came to visit, they remember the way you made them feel. And that when there was a point with my dad that I knew which aide was there, certified nursing aide, was there with him that day. There was one that just went the extra mile, the extra step. And I could tell from his attitude who it was on that day. I also want to make sure that we all remember that we're not just visiting for them to remember us and for them to make their day great. We're visiting for us. Mm-hmm. And that we're doing some of these things. I have, a sibling that says, you know, why do you bother? Why did you bother taking mom to the state fair, bringing the wheelchair, going through, having to push her? And I'm like, because she had a blast. And my daughter now has these wonderful memories. And we have memories of her being there with us, even though that night she went to bed. And this is usually our goal in our house, that my mom goes to bed and says, hey, you know what? I had a good day. And she may not remember what in the world she did, what she ate. She doesn't, but she has this feeling at night that she had a good day.
And actually, Karen, that has been proven research-wise that people with dementia who get in a certain mood, like they see something really, really sad, that even 3 hours later, when they can't tell you what they saw was sad, but they're still sad.
Right.
By the same token, if you bring joy to a person's life, they might not remember the joke or what you did, but for some reason, that emotional state lingers. And so if you can go and distract somebody who's having a bad day or bring a little bit of joy, it's not the joy for the 17 minutes of your visit. That joy is going to linger for probably maybe hours.
And spread. Spread throughout. If they're in a nursing home or assisted living, it's fairly amazing that when you walk in, and if there's one or two people who are having a bad day, something happened, you can see it all throughout the whole place. And if there's some joy to be spread, it is just like this domino effect. And so it does affect. I think that is a really important point to remember, that it is not just because they remember you. That's not the point. Go visit even for that little bit of time just to spread that joy and that love.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, Karen, a simple exercise or a simple trick that you can use with yourself and help other people use to help them remember and get in that moment, feel in the present moment as opposed to feeling the weight of the whole world on their shoulders? It's not that simple.
I wish I could
it?
Bottle that. Right, I wish, yeah. I could write that down. But I think it's like being a good listener. It's not something that goes, I'm going to do this today and I'm going to be a good listener. It is an art that you have to work mm-hmm. on all the time. We recently, 4 years ago, moved to the mountains, and we live in this little town in North Carolina surrounded by these gorgeous mountains. And my mom and I will get in the car and we'll be in a hurry and she'll sit down and all of a sudden we're driving and she'll go, and I'm like, what? And I stop the car and she says, the mountains, Karen, look, aren't they beautiful? And I tell you, most of the time, you forget. You yourself as a person to look around and just be present in the moments that happen.
Thank you so much, Karen. And thank you, Mercedes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen Stobey is a consultant who travels around helping other people who take care of their elderly loved ones. You can find information on her website. It's in-themoment.com. And Mercedes Bern-Klug is a professor of social work and director of aging studies at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.